stable first impression? Let's replay that first meeting scenario using dog psychology instead of human psychology. The proper way to approach a new dog is not to approach her at all. Dogs never approach each other face on unless they are challenging each other. And pack leaders never approach pack followers. The followers always approach him. There is such a thing as etiquette in the dog world, and a canine Emily Post would demand that when meeting a dog, you not make eye contact, you maintain calm, assertive energy, and you allow the dog to come to you. How will this dog check you out? By sniffing, of course. And don't be alarmed if she sniffs your crotch. Of course, among humans, it would be considered downright offensive to sniff someone's genitals upon first meeting him, but that's how dogs greet each other all the time. They usually don't mean anything sexual by it. It's simply a way that they get important information about each other. Gender, age, what the other dog had for lunch. A dog who sniffs you is getting similar information about you. While sniffing you, the dog is reading not only your scent, but also the all-important energy you're projecting. Now, that dog may end up not being very interested in you, and may wander off in search of other, more fascinating scents. Or she may stick around to explore you further. Once a dog has decided to initiate contact with you by nuzzling or rubbing up against you, only then should you offer affection to her. And save the eye contact for when you really know each other better. Sort of like not going too far on a first date. Sometimes, after examining a new person, a dog will lose interest and begin to wander away. Naturally, the dog lover will reach out after her and attempt to give her affection in order to bring her back. With some dogs, this can be perceived as an unwanted advance and can precipitate a bite. Even with a friendly dog, I usually suggest that people don't offer affection right away. Let the dog get to know you, feel comfortable with you, and do something to earn your affection first. This advice almost never goes over very well, because we humans get such a great sense of satisfaction from sharing affection with dogs. What most animal lovers don't understand is that by sharing affection first, we are not doing the dog any favors. We might be fulfilling our own needs. After all, dogs are so sweet and appealing and soft and fluffy. And as it turns out, they are important to both our physical and mental health as human beings. As animal behaviorist Patricia B. McConnell points out in her book, The Other End of the Leash, Why We Do What We Do Around Dogs, petting an animal can actually have significant physical benefits for people. According to McConnell, studies have shown that stroking a dog reduces heart rate and blood pressure in humans as well as in the dog, and releases chemicals in our brains that help soothe us and counteract the effects of stress. But when we come to a dog we barely know and offer unconditional affection right away, we may be creating a serious imbalance in our relationship with that dog, particularly if we are to be the dog's owner. A simple first meeting like this is often where behavior problems begin. Just like in the human world, to a dog, a first impression counts a lot. Many dog lovers may feel angry at me here, and let me make it clear that I understand that people have the best intentions in mind when giving a dog affection first. To reach out to another being with affection is a natural impulse for most of us, and part of what is most beautiful about being human. But we must try to remember that by doing so, we're fulfilling our own need for affection, not the dog's. Like most mammals, dogs do need and crave physical affection in their lives. But it's not the first and most important thing they need from you. If they get affection first, it tips the scales of your relationship in the wrong direction. Seeing things backward. You now understand how, in relating to dogs, we usually communicate everything to them backward, using sound, then sight, and generally ignoring scent. Dogs experience the world through scent, sight, and then sound, in that order. That's vital to remember if we want to communicate correctly with them. Never forget my formula. Nose, eyes, ears. Repeat it to yourself the way I repeat it to my clients, until it's second nature. There is another critical thing we do backward when we associate with dogs, although this concept is a little more difficult to understand. We relate to dogs the same way we do to humans, as a specific name or personality first. When I relate to people, I expect them to see me first as Caesar Milan, next as Hispanic male, last as human being, Homo sapiens. When we relate to one another, we rarely think about the species we belong to and almost never remember that we are all members of the animal kingdom. That information just doesn't enter into our minds when we meet our friends for coffee at Starbucks. A friend is a name and personality. Period. Naturally, we think of our dogs and most of our pets in this same way, name and personality first. In fact, we usually think of our dogs as name and personality, then breed, then human. Take a famous dog, say Paris Hilton's Chihuahua, Tinkerbell. We automatically think of the dog as a name first, Tinkerbell. At the same time, we might think of something about Tinkerbell's personality, say she's spoiled, or she wears cute outfits. Then we think of her as her breed, Chihuahua. Last, we remember that she is a dog, although the way she is always carried around from place to place in designer handbags and limousines, it would be easy to mistake her for a doll or a small child. Because Tinkerbell is so enmeshed in the human world, it rarely crosses our minds to think of her as animal, or to relate to her as such. But animal she is. This is another place where we go very wrong in how we communicate with our canines. When you interact with your dog, and this is most important when you are trying to deal with her issues or correct her behavior problems, you must relate to her this way, in this order. First, as number one, animal, number two, species, dog, Canis familiaris, then as number three, breed, Chihuahua, Great Dane, Collie, etc., and last and least important, number four, name, personality. This doesn't mean Paris can't love Tinkerbell for being Tinkerbell. What it does mean is that Paris needs to recognize the animal and species in Tinkerbell first, in order for Tinkerbell to live a well-adjusted life. All the designer handbags and limousines in the world won't make her a happy, balanced dog. Recognizing the animal in your dog. What do you think of when you think of the word animal? I think of nature, fields, forests, the jungle. I think of wolves, whose territories extend for miles and miles in their wild state. I think of two words in particular, natural and freedom. Every animal, including the human animal, is born with a deep-seated need to be free. But when we bring animals into our lives, by definition, they are not free anymore, at least not in the way that nature intended them to be. We contain them when we bring them into our environment. Most of the time, we do it for good and well-intentioned reasons. But regardless of whether it's a kitten, a chimpanzee, a horse, or a dog, whether we provide a one-room apartment or a mansion as big as Paris Hilton's, all animals still have the same needs that Mother Nature originally gave them. And if we're going to make the choice of having them live with us, we have a responsibility to fulfill those natural animal needs in them if we want them to be happy and balanced. Animals are beautifully simple. To them, life is also very simple. It's we who make it complicated for them by not allowing them to be who they are, by not understanding or even trying to speak their language, and by neglecting to give them what nature intended for them to have. The most important thing to know about animals is that they all live in the present, all the time. It's not that they don't have memories. They do. It's just that they don't obsess over the past or the future. When someone brings me a dog who attacked someone the day before, I look at her as a dog who is probably unbalanced and needs help today. But I don't think, oh, she's the dog who attacked a man yesterday. That dog isn't thinking about what she did yesterday, and she's not planning the strategy for her next bite. She didn't premeditate the first bite either. She only reacted. She's in the moment, and she needs help in that moment. That's perhaps the most wonderful revelation I have had from a life working with dogs. Every day when I go to work, dogs remind me to live in the present. Maybe I had a fender bender yesterday, or I'm worried about a bill I have to pay tomorrow. But being around animals, I am always reminded that the only real moment in life is now. Although humans are animals too, we are the only species that dwells on the past and worries about the future. We are probably not the only species that is aware of its own death, but we certainly are the only animals who actively fear it. Living in the moment, what animals do naturally, has become the holy grail for many human beings. Some people spend years learning to meditate or chant, and spend thousands of dollars going on retreats to monasteries on high mountaintops, trying to learn to live in the moment, if even for a little while. But almost all humans can't help but lose sleep over the past or the future some of the time, unless something dramatic happens in our lives. For example, take a person who almost dies. From that point on, suddenly the sky is beautiful, the trees are beautiful, his wife is beautiful, everything is beautiful. Finally, he understands the concept of living in the moment. Animals don't need to learn that lesson, because they are born with that insight. Human beings, of course, are also the only animals who use language. Though scientists have recently discovered that many animals, including primates, cetaceans, whales and dolphins, birds, and even bees, to name a few, have more intricate and complex communication systems than we ever imagined. Humans still remain the only animals who can put together complex words, thoughts, and concepts to create speech. Speech is our number one form of communication, and because we are so reliant on it, we neglect using our other four senses, or the sixth sense I describe in Chapter 2, the universal sense of energy. I'll repeat, all animals communicate using energy, constantly. Energy is beingness. Energy is who you are and what you are doing at any given moment. That's how animals see you. That's how your dog sees you. Your energy in that present moment defines who you are. Species, dog. Like all other animals, dogs have the inborn need for food and water, sleep, sex, and protection from the elements. Dogs are descended from wolves. In fact, the DNA of dogs and wolves is almost indistinguishable. Dogs can even mate with wolves and produce fertile offspring. Though there are many differences between domesticated dogs and wolves, we can learn much about our dogs' innate natures by observing wolf packs in the wild. Many North American wolves spend their springs and summers foraging for small game and fish, and their winters in organized hunts, pursuing mammals, sometimes as large as moose. Biologist L. David Meach observed wolves in the wild and noticed that only 5% of their hunts were successful. But the wolves still went out every day to hunt. They didn't get together and say, "You know, we've had a run of bad luck. Let's blow off the hunt today." Whether they caught their prey or not, they got up and went hunting. So the need to hunt, to go to work, is hardwired into wolves. Biologists and other experts think that somewhere between 10 and 12,000 years ago, the first proto-dogs learned that hanging around humans was an easier route to survival than all those frustrating hunts. They began supplementing their hunting by scavenging from human camps. But early humans did not give these dogs a free ride. They exploited the dog's natural ability to scent out and capture prey, and later, to keep farm animals in line and pull equipment too heavy for humans. So dogs have been working for thousands of years, whether for us or for themselves. Even if they're not going out to hunt every day, it's natural for them to expect to work for their food. It's what they were built for. Like all other animals on Earth, dogs need jobs. Nature designed them for a purpose, and that inbred desire for purpose does not go away when we bring them into our homes. Neither do the specific tasks humans have selectively bred into them, tasks such as hunting, retrieving, herding, running. But when we domesticate them, we often take their jobs away. We spoil them with comfortable beds, piles of squeaky toys, dishes of free, rich food, and tons of affection. We think, "What a life to be such a dog." Maybe that would indeed be a nice life for a retired accountant relaxing in a condo complex in Florida after 40 years on the job. But the genes of a canine are crying out for her to go out and wander with her pack, explore new territory, roam around, and search for food and water. Imagine how it would feel to have those ancient needs embedded deep inside you, then have to live your life locked up alone in a two-room apartment all day. Millions of city dogs live like that. Their owners think that taking the dog for a 5-minute walk to the corner to poop and pee is enough for them. Imagine how those dogs are feeling in their souls. Their frustration has to go somewhere. That's when they develop issues. And that's one of the ways I get so many clients. As long as dogs live with humans, their world will be turned upside down in this and countless other ways. It's our responsibility, if we want happy dogs, to try to remember who they are inside, who Mother Nature created them to be. When a dog has a problem, you can't fix it by connecting with the dog's name. You have to see the dog as animal first, dog second, before you can begin to deal with any issues she might have. The myth of the problem breed. When I go to see a first-time client, I sometimes don't know what the problem is that I'll be dealing with. I often don't even know the dog's breed. I like to come in cold and trust my instincts and observations because what the owner tells me is often very far from the source of the real problem. The first thing I'll do is sit down with the owner and listen to his side of the story. I can't count the number of times someone who has read too many books on dog breeds will say, "Well, because she's a Dalmatian, she's naturally nervous." Or, "He's part border collie, part pit bull, and it's the pit bull that's the problem." Or, "Dachshunds are always a problem breed." I have to explain to these clients that they're making a fundamental mistake by blaming the breed of a dog for its behavior problems. It's the same thing when people make generalizations about human races and ethnicities, that all Latinos are lazy, that all Irish are drunkards, or that all Italians are mobsters. When it comes to trying to understand and correct a dog's conduct, breed always comes third in importance after animal and dog. In my opinion, there's no such thing as a problem breed. However, there is no shortage of problem owners. Breed is something humans created. Geneticists and biologists believe that the first humans to live with dogs selected stray wolves with the smallest body size and teeth, perhaps because these animals would do less harm to us and be easier to control. Then, hundreds, perhaps thousands of years ago, we began to mate dogs to create offspring that would excel at certain tasks. Bloodhounds were bred to have heightened scenting abilities. Pit bulls were bred for fighting bulls. Sheepdogs were bred not only to herd sheep, but also to look like them. So today we have the German Shepherd, we have the Boxer, we have the Chihuahua, we have the Lhasa Apso, we have the Doberman. We have hundreds and hundreds of different breeds to choose from. When you are selecting a dog, breed is definitely important to keep in mind, and we'll go more deeply into that later. But it's vital to remember that every breed is still always an animal slash dog first. All dogs share the same psychology. The breed is just the outfit that that particular canine is wearing, and sometimes a set of special needs he or she might have. You're not going to be able to understand or control your dog's behavior by considering him or her simply as a victim of a breed. All dogs share the same innate abilities. But certain breeds have been selected to accentuate certain characteristics. We have a tendency to misinterpret those conditioned skills as the dog's personality. One conditioned skill is tracking ability. Because of their breeding, bloodhounds are naturally going to be better at it. They're going to be able to maintain themselves on the ground for longer periods of time. They don't care if they take a break to eat or not, as long as they find that scent. Can all dogs track? Can all dogs find things with their noses? Absolutely. They all recognize the world through smells, and all of them use their noses the way we use our eyes. But some of them are going to be better than others at sniffing out a target. This isn't to say the breed doesn't affect how sensitive a dog is to certain conditions and environments. In fact, the special needs a particular dog might have based on her breed is one of the most important things a new dog owner should be aware of when selecting a breed of dog for a companion. For example, in nature, all dogs travel, but Siberian Huskies were bred to travel for longer periods of time. The Siberian Husky, as a breed, can travel for days on end. That's its natural job. This innate ability, however, makes it harder for a Siberian Husky to live in the city because its genes are telling it to range over long distances and take long hikes to work off its excess energy. Without sufficient exercise, it will get frustrated more easily than, say, a dachshund. But when a Siberian Husky is frustrated, it will develop the same symptoms and side effects as a dachshund that's frustrated, or a pit bull that's frustrated, or a greyhound that's frustrated. Nervousness, fear, aggression, tension, territorial behavior, all these issues and illnesses result when the animal and the dog in her is frustrated. It doesn't matter what breed she is. That's why it's a mistake to obsess about the breed when you're dealing with a problem behavior. Once again, we come back to energy as the source of behavior. All animals, as individuals, are born with a certain level of energy. There are four levels of energy, regardless of the breed: low, medium, high, and very high. This is true for all species, including humans. Think of the people you know. Regardless of race, regardless of age or income, don't you know people who are naturally very low energy, who are couch potatoes? What about people who never seem to stop running around 24/7, or people who go to the gym for 2 hours a day, 7 days a week. I have two wonderful sons. My eldest, Andre, is medium energy, like my wife. Always thoughtful, but when working on a task, focused like a laser beam. My younger son, Calvin, on the other hand, is more like me. Very high energy. He's just naturally a ball of fire, and sometimes nothing can slow him down. No energy level is better or worse than any other. But when choosing a dog, it's a good idea to try to match your energy levels with hers, and vice versa. I tell my clients that they should never knowingly choose a dog with an energy level higher than their own. If you are a laid-back kind of person, I wouldn't recommend picking the one dog at the shelter that's jumping around madly in its cage. Choosing an energy level that's compatible between dog and owner is, in my estimation, far more important than choosing a breed, especially if you're looking at a mixed breed dog or rescuing a dog from a shelter. A dog by any other name. So now we're left with everybody's favorite subject, names. This is Billy. This is Max. This is Rex. This is Lisa. Names are something that we, human beings, create. We are the only species that gives its members names. Dogs don't look at a magazine and recognize Will Smith, Halle Berry, Robert De Niro, all those wonderful people. They don't see humans in that way. But we tend to see dogs in that way. Names go hand in hand with personalities. We're also the only species that identifies its members by their personalities. You can be the charming newscaster, or you can be the shifty politician. You can be the teacher who is patient and sweet, or the teacher who is stern and strict. Those are personalities. Although dogs don't recognize one another in that way, we tend to project our very human concept of personality onto them. What, you say? My dog Skipper has a very definite personality. In this area, I get a lot of argument and some resentment from dog lovers who think their dog is the absolute best, the most unique, original dog that ever lived. I do agree with you that every animal, like every snowflake, is one of a kind. But I challenge you to accept a new way of thinking. That your dog's personality may be something that you have projected onto her. You may be misinterpreting a natural condition, skill, or behavior for what to us humans seems like personality. You may even be calling a neurosis or problem a personality quirk, which isn't necessarily good for your dog. Let me give you an example. Let's say a man has two terriers. One is named Lady, the other Columbus. The owner named the one Columbus because he loves to explore. Lady is quiet and shy and never explores, so she's ladylike. That makes sense, doesn't it? A little terrier who pulls on his leash because he loves to explore, and another terrier who stays in the corner and acts like a little lady. According to the owner, the dogs were named after their personalities. But the truth of the matter is, all dogs love to explore. Exploration is part of their nature, and when I see a dog who doesn't seem to like checking out new things, she's unsure, she's fearful, I immediately know she has a problem. What this owner is doing is accentuating elements of his dog's behavior and labeling those elements as personality. In the animal world, there is dominant and there is submissive, which we'll soon look into more deeply. Lady is clearly the more submissive of the two dogs, and she also probably has a naturally lower energy level. But if we work on her self-esteem, we hope she will turn out to be just as curious as Columbus. Of course, in the natural world, dogs do recognize one another as individuals, but not in the same way that we do. Their mothers don't give them names. A mother will see her pups as the strong energy, the medium-level energy, or the low energy. Those are her kids. Her kids are energy. Her kids are a very distinct and recognizable scent. Later, when they grow up, the other members of the pack will also identify them as scent and energy, and their personality and name will correspond to where they fall in the group's hierarchy. It's a hard concept for us to get our minds around, but remember the main point of this chapter. Dogs see the world completely differently from the way we see it, not better or worse, and owners must learn to appreciate the unique psychology that comes from that disparate worldview. Most of the time, our pet's personality and name exist because we believe in them. Our wishing makes it so, and it makes us feel better to associate with her in this way. That's a beautiful thing, and very therapeutic for us as humans. That is, when it doesn't interfere with the dog's being a dog. But when a dog has issues, you can't begin to solve them by dealing with Columbus. You have to start with the animal, then the dog, then the breed, and then work your way down to the name stenciled on the food dish. Don't analyze this. Unfortunately for us humans, dogs can't lie down on a couch and be analyzed. They can't speak up and tell us what they want or need at any given moment. But in actuality, they are telling us all the time, with energy and body language. And if we understand their psychology by attending to their instincts, we really can fulfill their deepest needs. I often have clients who have adopted a dog with issues from a shelter and have spent months pondering what terrible thing might have happened to it as a puppy to have caused its present-day problems. They'll say about a troubled dog, "He must have been kicked by a woman with high-heeled shoes because now he's afraid of women with high-heeled shoes." Or, "She was scared by the garbage man, so now she goes crazy every time the truck goes by." All these things may be true, but these owners are talking about their dog's fears and phobias as if they were human fears and phobias, as if the dog sat and obsessed all day over a traumatic puppyhood or spent the free time worrying about garbage men and high-heeled shoes. They don't. Dogs don't think the way we do. To put it simplistically, they react. These fears and phobias are conditioned responses, and any conditioned response in a dog can be unconditioned if you understand the basics of dog psychology. Let me give you an example of a case from the first season of Dog Whisperer. Kane is a beautiful, sweet-tempered 3-year-old Great Dane who, while running and playing on a linoleum floor, slipped and skidded hard into a glass wall. His owner, Marina, heard the thud and rushed over to him, exclaiming, "Oh my God, Kane, are you all right? Oh, poor baby!" And on, with a lot of excited emotional energy. Although Marina meant well and was genuinely concerned for Kane's well-being, what she was doing was reinforcing Kane's natural distress at that moment. In nature, if Kane had been with a balanced dog from his pack, and the same kind of accident had occurred, the other dog might have sniffed him and checked him out to make sure everything was okay. Then Kane would have stood up, shaken himself off, and gone on with his day. He would have moved on, and perhaps have become a little more cautious about running on slippery surfaces. But because of his owner's reaction, Kane associated this minor accident with a major trauma, and a phobia was born. From that day on, Kane was terrified of shiny floors. For over a year, he wouldn't go into the kitchen, and he couldn't be taken to the school where Marina taught and had previously brought him every day. He wouldn't even go to the vet's. Marina always had to bring along a carpet fragment and roll it out in order to get Kane to walk through the veterinarian's waiting room. Marina tried coaxing and sweet-talking Kane into walking on linoleum, to no avail. She tried treats and affection. The more she begged and pleaded, the more she petted and cooed and comforted, the more stubborn and fearful Kane became. Plus, Kane weighed 160 pounds, so if he didn't want to go somewhere, no amount of pushing or pulling could make him go. Marina's approach to Kane's phobia might have been appropriate had Kane been a small child. A psychologist with a patient who has been in an airplane crash doesn't insist that the patient get back on an airplane during the first session. Similarly, when our human children have accidents, they do need some comforting and sympathy from us. But most parents realize that even children often react in proportion to their parents' reactions to their boo-boos. That's why we try to comfort our kids without making too much of their mishaps. But unlike human children, dogs don't dream about or obsess over past experiences the way we do. They live in the moment. Kane wasn't spending his days worrying about shiny floors, and he naturally reacted to protect himself when the original accident happened. But since his owner intensified the traumatic experience with her overly excited emotional energy, then nurtured that fear by giving him affection every time he got near a shiny floor, Kane now saw shiny floors as a very big deal indeed. Whenever an animal isn't allowed to move through its fear, that fear can become a phobia. What Kane needed was a calm, assertive pack leader to recondition him and show him that shiny floors were just business as usual. That's where I came in. First, I took Kane on a long walk with me in order to bond with him and ensure my dominant role. Once I was sure he saw me as his leader, I was ready to tackle his phobia. Because Kane is such a large dog, he weighs more than I do, I had to get a running start with him to get him into the hallway where the original accident had occurred. It took me 2 tries, but on the second, he ran in right next to me and was on the floor before he knew what was happening or how he'd gotten there. Once on the floor, he reacted as he'd been conditioned. He panicked. He squirmed. He drooled. You could see the terror in his eyes. The difference this time was me. I did nothing but hold him steady. I stayed calm, strong, and unaffected by his reaction. I didn't comfort him or talk sweetly to him the way Marina always had. That behavior had only reinforced his negative responses. Instead, I sat with him while he went through all the old emotions, and I watched the fear literally drain out of him. In under 10 minutes, he was relaxed enough for me to start walking with him on the shiny floor itself. He tottered next to me, shaky and unsure at first, but after a few passes back and forth, his confidence began to return. Once again, I stayed calm and assertive. I didn't baby him. I offered him the guidance of a strong pack leader and communicated with my energy that this was a normal activity and nothing to be afraid of. In well under 20 minutes, Kane was striding confidently on the same floors he'd been afraid of for more than a year. The big test came when Marina and her son Emmett had to take over for me. Marina expressed to me how difficult it was for her to project calm, assertive energy when she was so worried about how Kane was feeling. It's a natural thing for a human to feel sympathy for another animal who's in distress, but dogs don't need our sympathy. They need our leadership. We are their reference point and their source of energy. They reflect the psychological energy we are communicating to them. It was quite a challenge for Marina to learn how to be Kane's leader when her heart was bleeding for him and she believed her role was to be his mom. To her credit, however, she worked hard to change and taught both her husband and son to be better pack leaders as well. Among animal behaviorists and human psychologists, the technique I used with Kane is sometimes known as flooding, the prolonged exposure of a patient to fear-arousing stimuli of relatively high intensity. To some animal advocates, this technique is very controversial. I believe that when working with animals, people need to follow their own consciences. In my opinion, the way I worked with Cain was not only humane, it was also instantly effective. Since that day, Cain has had no more problems with shiny floors, or any other phobias for that matter. He's a wonderfully balanced, calm, peaceful dog. The beauty of dogs is that, unlike humans with psychological issues, dogs move on right away, and they don't look back. We humans have the blessing and curse of imagination, which allows us to soar to the heights of science and art and literature and philosophy, but which can take us also to all sorts of dark and scary places in our minds. Since dogs live in the now, they don't hold on to the past the way we do. Unlike the Woody Allens of the world, dogs don't need years of therapy or long sessions on a couch struggling to understand what happened to them when they were puppies. When it comes down to it, they are creatures of cause and effect. Once they've been conditioned to react in a new way, they are not only willing, but also able to change. As long as we show them strong, consistent leadership, they can move forward and overcome nearly any phobia they've acquired. Chapter 4. Power of the Pack. There's an aspect of your dog's psychology that I only touched on in the last chapter, but it couldn't be a more important concept when it comes to understanding the relationship between you and the dogs in your life. This is the concept of the pack. Your dog's pack mentality is one of the greatest natural forces involved in shaping his or her behavior. A dog's pack is his life force. The pack instinct is his primal instinct. His status in the pack is his self, his identity. The pack is all important to a dog, because if anything threatens the pack's harmony, it threatens each individual dog's harmony. If something threatens the pack's survival, it threatens the very survival of every dog in it. The need to keep the pack stable and running smoothly is a powerful motivating force in every dog, even in a pampered poodle that has never met another dog or left the confines of your backyard. Why? It's deeply ingrained in his brain. Evolution and Mother Nature took care of that. It's vital for you to understand that your dog views all his interactions with other dogs, with you, and even with other animals in your household in the pack context. Even though I've spent the last chapter outlining the many differences between how dogs and humans see the world, humans, in fact, all primates, are pack animals too. In fact, dog packs are really not so different from the human equivalent of packs. We call our packs families, clubs, football teams, churches, corporations, governments. Sure, we think of our social groups as infinitely more complicated than dogs' groups. But are they really all that different? When you break it down, the basics are the same. Every one of the packs I've mentioned has a hierarchy, or it doesn't work. There is a father or mother, a chairman, a quarterback, a minister, a CEO, a president. Then there are varying levels of status for the people under him or her. That's how a pack of canines works, too. The concept of pack and pack leader is directly related to the way in which dogs interact with us when we bring them into our homes. The natural pack. If you study a wolf pack in the wild, you'll observe a natural rhythm to its days and nights. First, the animals in the pack walk sometimes up to 10 hours a day to find food and water. Then they eat. If they kill a deer, the pack leader gets the biggest piece, but everyone cooperates in sharing the rest. They'll eat until the entire deer is gone, not just because they don't have saran wrap in the wild, but because they don't know when there's going to be another deer again. What they eat today may have to hold them for a long time. That's where the expression wolfing down food comes from. And you'll see it in your own dog's behavior much of the time. Wolves don't necessarily eat just when they're hungry. They eat when the food is there. Their bodies are designed to conserve. It's the root of your own dog's often seemingly insatiable appetite. Only after wolves and wild dogs have finished their daily work do they play. That's when they celebrate, and in nature, they usually go to sleep exhausted. Not once, while watching the dogs on my grandfather's farm, did I ever see a sleeping dog having nightmares, the way domestic dogs in America do. Their ears would twitch. Their eyes would move, but there was no whimpering or whining or moaning. They were so completely worn out from their day's work and play that they slept peacefully every night. Every pack has its rituals. These include traveling, working for food and water, eating, playing, resting, and mating. Most important, the pack always has a pack leader. The rest of the animals are followers. Within the pack, the animals fall into their own order of status, usually determined by that animal's inborn energy level. The leader determines and enforces the rules and boundaries by which the members will live. I've already explained that a puppy's first pack leader is his mother. From birth, puppies learn how to be cooperative members of a pack-oriented society. At about 3 or 4 months after they're weaned, they fall into the regular pack structure and take their cues from the pack leader, not their mother. In packs of wolves and wild dogs, the leader is often a male because the hormone testosterone, present in male puppies from the time they are very small, seems to be a cue to dominance behaviors. You'll see a male puppy mounting both other males and females long before he is sexually mature. And no, that doesn't mean he's bisexual. It means he's acting out in play the dominance and submission behaviors that will be such a big part of his future life as an adult dog. Though hormones are part of what makes a pack leader, energy plays an even greater role. When humans live in households with more than one dog, the dominant dog can be either male or female. The gender doesn't matter, only the inborn energy level and who establishes dominance. In many packs, there is an alpha couple, a male and female pair who seem to run things between them. In the wild, pack leaders are born, not made. They don't take classes to become leaders. They don't fill out applications and go on interviews. Leaders develop early, and they show their dominant qualities quite young. It's that all-important energy we discussed earlier that separates the pack leader from the follower. A pack leader must be born with high or very high energy. The energy must also be dominant energy, as well as calm, assertive energy. Medium and low energy dogs do not make natural pack leaders. Most dogs, like most humans, are born to be followers, not leaders. Being a pack leader isn't only about dominance, it's also about responsibility. Think about our own species and the percentage of people who would like to have the power and perks of the president or the money and goodies of a Bill Gates. Then tell those people that the trade-off is that they will have to work around the clock, 24/7, almost never see their families, and rarely take weekends off. Tell them they'll be financially responsible for thousands of people or responsible for the national security of hundreds of millions of people. How many people would choose those leadership roles after being presented with such daunting realities? I believe most people would choose comfortable but simpler lives over great power and wealth if they truly understood the work and sacrifice that leadership costs. Similarly, in a dog's world, the pack leader has the responsibility for the survival of all the pack members. The leader leads the pack to food and water. He decides when to hunt, decides who eats, how much, and when, decides when to rest and when to sleep and when to play. The leader sets all the regulations and structures that the other pack members must live by. A pack leader has to have total confidence and know what he's doing. And just as in the human world, most dogs are born to follow rather than do all the work it takes to maintain the position of pack leader. Life is easier and less stressful for them when they live within the rules, boundaries, and limitations that the pack leader has set for them. For a dog born with a dominant disposition and energy, yes, it is harder and may take a little longer for him to accept a human as his leader. Such animals were not born to be followers, but their instinct for being in a smoothly running pack is stronger than their instinct for being the one and only leader. It is important to remember that a very dominant, high-energy dog should only be with a human who has the energy, skills, and knowledge for being the leader for a dominant, strong-breed dog. The person who chooses a dominant, strong-breed dog also must make a commitment to leadership and needs to take that commitment seriously. As we've discussed before, pack leaders project calm, assertive energy. Even if you've never observed a pack of dogs or wolves before, it shouldn't take you long to pick out the leader. He will have a dominant posture, head alert, chest forward, ears up, tail stiff. Sometimes he almost swaggers. Pack leaders are clearly very confident dogs, and it comes naturally to them. They aren't faking it, and they couldn't if they tried. Their followers, on the other hand, project the energy known as calm submission. They walk with their heads in line with their bodies, or down, and they stay behind the pack leader while traveling, their ears relaxed or back, their tails wagging but always kept low. If the pack leader challenges them, they might back away, bend down, or even lie down and roll over, exposing their bellies. By doing that, basically they're saying, "You're the boss, and I'm not questioning that. Whatever you say goes." No room for weakness. In nature, if a pack leader shows any weakness at all, he will be attacked and replaced by a stronger member of the pack. This is true across all animal species that live in tiered social systems. Only the strong can lead. In fact, extreme weakness among any member of the pack is not to be tolerated. If there is a dog in the pack that is unusually weak or timid, he will be assaulted by the others. Weakness doesn't cut it among any animal species except our own. This is one of the most interesting differences between modern human beings and the rest of the animal kingdom. Not only do we accept weakness in some of our pack members, we also actually rescue our weak brothers and sisters. We rehabilitate people in wheelchairs. We tend to our sick. We risk our lives to save a pack member who might not make it anyway. While what some researchers call altruistic behavior has been documented in many other species, especially the other high primates, compared with most other animals, human beings take this kind of graciousness to an extraordinary level. Not only do humans rescue our own, we save other animals too. We are the only species that rescues seagulls, crocodiles, hyenas, and whales. You'll never see a zebra rescuing an injured elephant. Think about the animal lovers you know, dog lovers, lion lovers, horse lovers. Every animal seems to have its own fan club among humans, a group of people with such compassion for a chosen species that they'll rescue even the sorriest specimen of that species. Many of the dogs at my dog psychology center came to me in such bad shape that it was their last chance, and I brought them back from the brink. I've got a dog with three legs, a dog with no ears, a dog with one eye, and a dog who's the product of such severe inbreeding, he's always going to be mentally handicapped. It's because I'm a human, and I feel sorry for these dogs, that I'll do whatever it takes to give them another chance at a full, happy life. But in their natural habitat, other dogs don't feel sorry for the frail and the feeble. They attack and execute them. There's nothing intentionally cruel about it. Remember, we're also the only species with a system of morality, of right and wrong. It's simply that a weak animal endangers the rest of the pack, and nature has ingrained in animals the instinct to breed together the strongest members, so the next generation will have a better chance of surviving to breed again. Nature polices its own. Our tendency to rescue others comes from our emotional energy. Our compassion and our loving natures are beautiful things and part of the miracle of being human. But to other animals, emotional energy can be perceived as weakness. Love is a soft energy, so when it comes to pack survival at least, love on its own is indeed a kind of weakness. Animals won't follow soft or weak energy. They won't follow compassionate energy. St. Francis of Assisi and his birds notwithstanding, animals won't follow a spiritual leader. They won't follow a lovable leader, nor will they follow overly excited energy. We are a pack-oriented species, but as I've said, we are also the only species on the planet that will follow an unstable leader. Animals, whether horses, dogs, cats, or sheep, will follow only a stable leader. That leader's balance is reflected in his consistently calm, assertive energy. So when we project excited or loving or emotional or even overly aggressive energy to the animals in our lives, especially if that is the only energy we're projecting, they are much more likely to see us as followers, not as leaders. To lead or to follow. To dogs, there are only two positions in a relationship: leader and follower, dominant and submissive. It's either black or white. There is no in-between in their world. When a dog lives with a human, in order for the human to be able to control the dog's behavior, she must make the commitment to take on the role of pack leader 100% of the time. It's that simple. It doesn't seem that simple, however, for many of my clients. Hundreds of them keep calling me because they are desperate because their dog's problem behaviors are totally controlling their lives. Perhaps some of them have a hard time getting their minds around the dominant-submissive paradigm because in the human world, those words sometimes come with baggage attached. When we hear the word dominance, perhaps we think of a wife beater, a drunk in a bar fight, a playground bully extorting lunch money from the classroom runt, or even a masked man or woman in an S&M club with leather and whips. The word conjures up images of cruelty in our minds. It's important to remember that in the animal kingdom, the word cruelty doesn't exist, and dominance isn't a moral judgment or an emotional experience. It is simply a state of being, a behavior that is as natural in nature as is mating or eating or play. Submissive, as we refer to it here, is not an ethical judgment either. It doesn't designate an animal or human who is a wimp or overly pliable. Submissive doesn't mean vulnerable or ineffectual. It is merely the energy and the state of mind of a follower. Among all pack species, there has to be some degree of dominance and submission in order for any hierarchy to function. Think of an office full of workers. What would happen if they all came in and left whenever they felt like it, took four-hour lunches, and argued with one another and with the boss all day? It would be chaos, right? You don't consider an employee who comes to work on time, gets along with her fellow workers, and completes her tasks with a minimum of conflict to be weak, do you? No, You consider her to be cooperative, a good team player. But in order for there even to be a team, that employee has to accept a degree of submission in her mindset. She has to implicitly understand that the boss makes the decisions, and it's her job to follow them. At the risk of being considered politically incorrect, I still use the terms dominant and submissive.